Hey, everybody, Scott here. Welcome back to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We are thrilled about this one. But let's talk about some of the sponsors real quick before we get into our episode. One of our sponsors is a woman by the name of Susan Robb out of Toronto, Canada. She lives out her mission to inspire others. Susan is a client partner for the Center for Leadership Studies, original home of situational leadership. CLS is deployed in over 70% of top Fortune 500 companies. Susan is also has a business as a speaker agent. Many of those speakers have been on our show, most recently Sunjay Nath. She can set you up with workshops or public speaking or different arranged speakers to come in and provide you with all sorts of professional development. So contact Susan Robb, R-O-B-B, on LinkedIn. Susan is a great woman that helps us out greatly on this show. Now, one of our sponsors is Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. Some of the best craft beer around, with 16 rotating taps all the time in their wonderful tap room. They're a perfect room for Halloween skulls and just amazing murals on the wall. This Sunday, they just released Out of Their Gourd, their Acorn Squash Abbey Ale. And then this Sunday coming up, they're going to be releasing a Baltic Porter brewed with Mo Mountain Hot Sauce. That sounds awesome and interesting. So go check out Demented Brewing. Give them some love on the old Facebook and Instagram machine, at Demented Brewing. Joe Fisher from Manskirt. Manskirt Brewing is a brewery located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. It also sponsors the show. They're right in the old bank building there on Main Street. They have big news with Better Than Pants. Their delicious English ale is available in cans this week. Go check out Manskirt. Show them some love on Facebook and Instagram. Now, the third brewery that sponsors this podcast, I was just there at their Oktoberfest, is the Adirondack Brewery, and boy, was it a good time. Go check out some of the videos. They just tapped their Harvest Rye IPA, 7% alcohol, 50 IBU, delicious beer. They brewed with too many whole cone cascade hops to count. It's truly an expression of upstate New York agriculture. All hops for the beer were sourced from local Cold Spring hop farms in Hebron, New York. Bold pine and citrus notes are backed by subtle rye spiciness. Also, Adirondack Brewery next event is on November 4th, and it's Pumpkin Chunkin'. Not sure what to do with those pumpkins rotting on your porch? Bring them up to Lake George and launch them at Targets with a variety of catapults. The whole family's welcome activities include pumpkin catapults, apple slingshots, magician's act, food truck, bounce houses, keg mazes, and, of course, beer. We went last year. It was a whole lot of fun. Go check out Adirondack Brewing. Now, our newest sponsor to the show, Sleep Ovation. We love working with these guys. Are you waking up with back pain? 50% of Americans are. I know I do. Sleep Ovation's new mattress is 700 tiny little mattresses that individually cradle natural curves of your spine. This provides perfect comfort and spine support for back pain relief and the best damn sleep of your life, man. Pre-order yours now at sleepovation.com. Use the promo code VERBAL and get $100 off your order. It's just really cool mattress technology, guys. You really just got to check it out. Go check them out at sleepovation.com and give them some love on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is a trivia company all over New Jersey, and craft beer bars and breweries play trivia each week. I host at Tap House 15 on Wednesdays. Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Now, this is part one of our Halloween episode. We made two parts because we had such great guests and a lot of hours of fun content and interviews. So the first one up today on the show, we have Bishop Brian Ouellet. I think I pronounced his name yet. Brian Ouellet. He is an exorcist bishop. Okay, he performs exorcisms. He's a metaphysician, an esotericist, and belongs to the Nicolaitan Church. Very interesting. You're just going to get into the world of exorcists and spirits, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here is Bishop Brian. Enjoy the podcast.
Yes, this is Bishop Brian Ouellet of the Holy Nicolaitan Catholic Church, and I am an exorcist for the Order of Exorcists in the Atlanta, Georgia Division, and you've been listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheap and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh, yeah. All right. I've been pumped up about this one for weeks.
You have.
I have.
You've been talking about
it. You know what? There's preparation sometimes. Not too often. But there's two episodes a year that I like to get a little prepared for. Mm-hmm. Definitely one of them. It's the Halloween episode and the Christmas episode. We usually try to theme it out a little bit. We've also had President's Day episodes.
Yeah, the 50th episode.
New Year's Eve episode we've had before. But the Halloween episode is, for some reason, I tend to like the Halloween episode a lot. I don't know why. I think there's always a lot to talk about. And we are loaded with guests for this one coming up.
Yeah, man. Huge.
This might even be a two-parter, guys. I'm not going to lie. It might be a two-parter. We'll release both at once. You could listen to either one. But we have a lot planned, a lot of fun stuff. So welcome back to the episode. And Berlo, happy early Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Halloween.
Oh, man. There ain't nothing like a Hobbill Halloween.
That's the name of the episode. The Happy Hobbill Halloween special.
Oh, man. When the Hobbills come out with the Halloween party, man, that stuff is sick.
Love them. But, I'm back from the Adirondacks. I went away to the Adirondack Brewery this weekend.
How did that go?
Pretty good. In fact, we are drinking tasty Adirondack brews.
Yeah.
But I posted on our Instagram, and I figure I had to address this and tell the story. So every time I go up there on the Oktoberfest, I enter the keg throwing competition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the keg is full, okay? So every time I do it, I am very nervous beforehand. I'm like, this is the year I'm not going to be able to get it up, and I'm going to fall down or just look like a clown.
And I'm going to be the guy that's going to swing it and let it go in the backwards direction.
Yeah. And I'm like, they only had 30 in the list. I was like 26 signed up. Like only have 30. 30 are allowed to enter the competition.
Okay.
So we're all waiting around, and people are gathering. It's kind of like the event of the October. Like everyone, fun to watch. It really is fun to watch. And
like, how much does that thing weigh?
160, they said.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really heavy. It's really, and then it's always sitting there, like when you sign up, and I'm like always like, oh man, I wonder if I can get it up there. Like, I always feel like I'm gonna embarrass myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, you know, and I've done well in the past. Like, all right, let's do it. So everyone's gathered, and like, so I'm 26, so there's a long wait.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting nervous. I'm like, but then I see the guys that are going. A lot of them are trying to do just like with their arms and kind of like heave ho it.
You can't.
It's too heavy to get any kind of arc on it. Like, you're not going to get it up and throw it.
Yeah.
You need some force. You have to get it on your shoulder. You have to. If you get it on your shoulder, you at least have one, just a drop of it going forward. And two, you can get your hands underneath it to try to launch it.
Okay.
I've had some experience doing this, so I know.
Like, and how many times have you done this?
Probably 5.
Wow.
Yeah. 4 to 5, probably.
Okay.
And one year I came in third. One year I stepped on the board, so I got a disqualification, which sucks. It's really depressing.
Was it a good throw, or at least you go, oh, I was going to win anyway?
I think
it was
okay. And then the one year I thought I was going to win, this big mook comes out of the back in the kitchen. He was like one of the chefs, and he just comes and launches it like a frisbee. Like, it was, yeah. He'd be probably like a foot and a half at least.
Like, he throws it and it's like, don't worry, we'll be back next year.
Yeah. Goodbye, guys. And he goes, like, ran back into the, back into the kitchen and started cooking. So, it's my turn, and actually before that, there was a guy next to me, real nice guy, pretty big dude, older, probably like 50. He's like, oh, you know the secret to this? I'm like, well, you got to get it on your shoulder. I'm like, trust me.
The secret's to throw it.
And so he goes. He went like third, and he did really well. He was in first all the way until I went. And I went, I'm all pumped up, and adrenaline's flying. And
like, did
I
you even, do like what some of my warm ups before I used to do comedy?
No, I'm more of like still in my head panicking. Like I try not to, but my knees are like shaking and stuff like that. I'm like, oh. So I get up and I get the keg on my shoulder, like pretty one swift moment, like clean and jerk it kind of. And I decide to try to rally the crowd up, and I'm like waving my hand. I launched it. I got 8.8 feet 4 inches was my throw. And I lost it. I had like an out of body experience. I was like, let's go. High five, and everyone's screaming. It's like a old tribal test of masculinity. Yeah. I don't know. It just like, it takes over. It's like, I guess when like a football player like levels someone, it's like they just act like a moron. Yeah, like I couldn't help it. Like it just came out of me. And I'm like, I got this. There were only four guys to go. And of course, the last guy, they're like, whatever, Greg or whoever, read the name. And I look over, and this dude, he's like our height, but probably another 40 pounds and just big. He looks like he just hurls things for a living. Like, that's what
that's
he does.
That's his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's got like cargo jeans on and boots. And I'm like, this guy's definitely just a big, burly man. And dude, he picks the thing up like a donut and just, he beat me probably by a foot and launched it. But,
wow.
And I was like joking with him. I'm like, you had to go last. Like, you couldn't go. So I knew I was in second. Like, you had to go 30th and ruin it.
You think they put a ringer in there just to spoil it for you?
No, because the brewery, first off, kudos to the Adirondack Brewery. Awesome event. Bigger than ever. It was 1,000 people. But it was nice because it's big enough space where you're not crowded and there's no lines for beer and there's a band playing all the time. It's just a lot of fun. Maybe go next year. They gave out prizes. I won a shirt, a glass, and a six pack, the Oktoberfest that we're drinking. And they treated me like royalty. They covered our ticket, because they sponsored the podcast and whatnot. And it was just a really fun time, a really, really good event. It's funny, for like that last hour, there was like an hour left after that. Felt like a local celebrity, man. People were coming up like, oh, man, great throw. I'm like, yeah. And then I'm like, I wish I was good at, like, something meaningful, you know? Yeah.
Grandpa, stop telling us about the time he came second place in the keg throwing contest.
In the middle of the Adirondacks, like, I don't know. But it was
local legend talks about the Brennan.
It was a
heaving his keg as far as you could see.
It was a good time, though. I will tell that. So,
Ooh, pumpkin calling. Ooh, pumpkin calling. Mm-hmm. Ooh,
Scott,
pumpkin,
do we have a call?
Oh, no.
Ooh, pumpkin calling.
Scott,
call coming in.
Pumpkin calling.
Should I
pumpkin calling,
take it?
Pick up your phone.
Oh, God. Hello?
Oh,
no.
Oh, I think I know this guy, Scott.
Oh, Lord, it's me. Hey, boys.
Who's this? Bro.
I think I know this guy. You're never around when I talk to him, but...
What? Who the hell is this?
I don't know.
That's right. The Hacker Lantern. Oh, Lordy, Lordy, Lordy. Oh, God.
The Hacker Lantern.
Yeah, I've talked to him about 2 or 3 times already. This guy's kind of a regular. I'm surprised you're in the room now for once.
What?
There was
is
a
it
room
guy?
Where, yeah, I guess so. I mean... I've never met him before. I mean, there was legend that it was you, but obviously we're in the same room together, so it's not you.
I would call myself the Hack-O-Lantern.
I mean, I don't know.
Is he like a...
He's like a 8-foot-tall pumpkin who tells crappy jokes.
An 8-foot-tall pumpkin who tells crappy jokes.
Yeah, that's what happened.
That seems rather odd.
Hey, Michael Berlew! Berlew, what are you, cold or something? Oh, God!
Oh, I get it. I get it. Because it's
Burr. Yeah.
Burr.
Yeah.
Oh, so this is your type of humor.
Like, he should have said, and all, is your Uncle Lou cold? That would have been, like, more precise.
So there's a pumpkin on the line. That's pretty cool.
It's interesting.
Oh, it's Scott Brennan! Should be called Cot Brennan if you've ever seen his act. Makes me go right to sleep. Oh,
that's
go!
Well, he knows you pretty well.
That's not funny, though. That's just not
funny. But he knows you pretty well.
Caught Brennan? What? I don't get it.
That's right, baby. The hottest little pumpkin on the pumpkin patch. Yeah! Yeah!
He's very aggressive.
Yeah, He did say what I told you. He is a pumpkin.
So you've been called before by this guy.
Yeah, I mean, he calls at the random times. It's very weird. It's been a while. I think it's been about a year now.
Tap, tap, tap. Hey, is this thing on? This thing on? How come I don't even know laughs? You guys must be drunk or something. It's hilarious.
Well, he might be right about that, but... I mean, I don't know the setup about that.
Why, Hacklender, you're not funny. Like, atrocious, actually.
I think it's secret.
Time for you to hear some of my new material, baby.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, baby. Mm. Oh, baby, I get all randy just thinking about it.
Now, he seems pretty excited.
Let me put him on mute for a second. Brother, like, has his material ever been good?
I would say one step above Doug Max, but that doesn't say much.
You heard Jared from somewhere going to prison?
Yes.
Yeah, you heard that? Huh? He's going to be the one looking for that $5 footlong. Oh, God! 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 God!
Huh. Wow. Very original take.
I mean, he's been in jail for about, what, a year and a half? I mean, it took that long for the joke?
For the five. Maybe he's been touring these jokes. Maybe he's been working them on the road, developing his material.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, president. Bye, Obama. Orange is the new black. Oh, yeah.
I think I've heard that one before.
I think I've heard that at 30 mics and about 20 shows.
Wasn't at that show.
Oh, God.
Donald Trump want to build a wall to keep out Mexicans. Then let me ask you, who's going to build it? Oh, God.
He's very excited about his jokes.
It's kind of obnoxious.
I mean, you got to give him credit. If he doesn't get an audience, he gets himself and be equally as loud.
Never heard that Donald Trump joke.
No.
Never. All right.
He's enjoying himself.
Never heard any joke about who's going to build the wall.
Every time we mute him, he comes right back strong.
All these teachers getting caught sleeping with their students, man. Man, what the hell was wrong with me when I was in high school? Oh, my God.
It seems Hacklander's on the road.
It does. Sounds like he's in a car. Yeah. Or some. How does a pumpkin drive?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of weird, like, number one, how he got your number, and two, he's
well, it's
on the
show
road.
Line, you know.
Oh, all right. We got to promote that more. Yeah.
Gay marriage, it's legal now. Good. Let them go through all the misery that I'm in. Oh!
Hasn't gay marriage been around for like 3 years now?
Very, very topical.
Yeah.
Hack-a-lantern.
Anybody celebrate anything? Marriage? Divorce? Colonoscopy? Oh, baby. I'm puttering out.
Is he opening
a
show?
Is he crowd working us?
Wow.
I think I've used that line before. That's weird.
I got a weird look. I know, you staring at me. I kind of look like the Syracuse Orange mascot. Bang the Great Pumpkin. Oh!
Two things here. Number one, I've heard that from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And two, it sounds like during the joke, Hack-a-Lantern hit something and just went back to it.
Oh, I mean, it's almost like we can get him to tell it again, maybe.
I mean, it's a strong joke.
You guys heard about Hugh Hefner?
Nope.
He gone. Oh, he
no.
gone.
Topical. Oh, no.
They went to read his will, but the pages were stuck together. Oh, God, man.
Wow. Hugh Hefner joke.
I guess it's topical.
No, I'm kind of
a little Woody Woodpecker laugh there.
He's. It's funny how he sounds just like a Chris Rock, basically.
Yeah. But I know a guy who sounds like.
All right, verbal shablamblams. I'm in and out of here. Got to get back to the pumpkin patch. Got to go celebrate Halloween. Big show coming up for the Hag Lantern. Closing it out as always.
Bye, buddy.
You know it. You know it. I love you guys. I get out of here. Oh God.
Hack-a-lantern doesn't seem like a closer.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Oh, he came back there for a minute. He doesn't seem like a closer, Hack-a-lantern.
What the hell was that?
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those kindred spirits with the show. Comes once a year. Maybe we should call him back more often.
I don't know. Maybe like, once a year is
like
enough.
Like Heart-a-lantern during Valentine's Day.
Shamrock-a-lantern. Wow. Well, speaking of kindred spirits, should we get to our guest?
Yeah. Why wouldn't we?
It's time to get a little scared, you know.
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
But it's a big day on the podcast. It's a Halloween themed guests here. And this is a cool one. I reached out to this guy probably about a month ago, and we were able to set this up. Now, he is a exorcist bishop, metaphysician, and esotericist. He's also part of the Nicolaitan Church.
The Nicolaitan Church. Okay. Mark Summers was a part of that.
Yes. So I guess he's involved in exorcisms and all sorts of stuff like that. So, and we're going to get him on the line. And should be pretty cool here, man.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
Yep. So let's get Bishop Brian on the line. Get scared.
Hello, this is Bishop Brian.
Hey, Bishop Brian. It's Scott Brennan and Mike Berlew from Verbal Shenanigans. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How about you?
We're doing great, man.
Doing great.
We are recording our annual Halloween episode, and the hardest thing for me is how do we pronounce your last name correctly? I want to see if I got it correct.
It is Willett, like a W.
Oh, I butchered it.
Scott went French on that one.
I went Olouette, like you got a lot of vowels. It's not fair.
just think of it like you know, you ever see a Ouija board?
Oh,
all right, yeah, I got it.
You know, when you have in French, if you have an O and a U with a vowel after it, like an I or an E, it makes a W sound. Go figure.
Brian, like I said, thanks for giving us a few minutes. I'm sure you get many a call or a inquiry around this time of year. But let's start. What is the Nicolaitan Church? Like, you don't hear it too often. I actually had to Google it a little bit and kind of get some information on it when I was looking for you. So what is the Nicolaitan Catholic Church, and how is it different than, say, a Roman Catholic Church or any other type of Catholic church that we commonly know?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a good question, and it is something that I think does create a bit of confusion, because there is this understanding out there that Catholicism is the Church of Rome.
Right.
And that is sort of, I think they kind of like having that monopoly on the word. They don't really do too much to correct people's understanding of the history. But there's actually Catholicism's a lot larger than the Church of Rome. The Church of Rome is just where Catholicism originated with.
Right.
There are moments in history throughout various points in time where there were disagreements that came up. The first great disagreement in the church was in 1054 AD with the Great Schism that broke the Church of Rome with the other five original churches of the East, which was the Church of Antioch, the Church of Constantinople, the Church of Jerusalem, the Church of Alexandria, Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
That's what became, after 1054, those five Eastern churches that broke off became what is now known as Eastern Orthodoxy, and then the Church of Rome started calling itself the Catholic Church or the Roman Catholic Church. And then, you know, you had the Protestant Reformation 500 years later. And then a few hundred years after that, there was some disagreement over some papal authority that eventually led to a schism in Europe that where a an entire diocese with several other bishops from the Roman Catholic Church decided that they were going to break away from the authority of the Vatican. Because they didn't agree with certain decisions the Pope was making. And that eventually became the foundation to what is now known as the Old Roman Catholic Church, or the Old Catholics. The Old Catholics were the first independent Catholics, independent meaning that they're no longer under the authority of the Church of Rome. And they started ordaining their own priests and consecrating their own bishops, which eventually led to different sects of the independent Catholicism, and then as it made its way over to the United States of America, it even expanded more rapidly. And so the Holy Nicolaitan Catholic Church is an extension from the old Roman Catholics, and now we're back in communion with them through the Order of Exorcists, fortunately. The Nicolaitan Catholic Church is an established Catholic Church under what is referred to today as the Independent Sacramental Movement. So it's fully Catholic. We have apostolic succession. We have all of the authority of the church, along with all of the recognized validity. But we would be considered illicit in the eyes of the Vatican just because of the nature of the fact that they would prefer that they had administrative control over Catholicism, and now Catholicism is bigger than they are. So... that's kind of where we come from, and we are a very particular tradition. We were established several years ago out of a committee of Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and independent Catholic members, some clergy, some laity, and the church was founded with the hope to bring better unity to Catholicism, to kind of bring us back to our original purpose as an ancient church, and remove a lot of the political red tape that now I think a lot of people would say has damaged the value and the beauty and the holiness of the Holy Roman Catholic Church. So we're not in disagreement. We don't refute the Roman Catholic Church. Some independent Catholic churches do. You know, we still very much adhere to the Catechism, with a few exceptions that are particular to our tradition. But really, the only difference between a Nicolaitan Catholic Church and a Roman Catholic Church is who has the ultimate authority. Is it the Pope of Rome, or is it the presiding bishop of the church? That's where it comes down to.
No. I assume you were a priest in this church. Your bishop? Is it the same structure as the Catholic Church that we know? Like, are you is the priest unable to be married and stuff, or is it kind of a whole different structure?
Well, you know, as far as structure, it is different in that respect. Because we only are required to adhere to the sacramental theology of the Catholic tradition. So we don't modify what the Church of Rome has established to be the necessary elements that make the sacraments of the church valid. So, for example, as much as we would love to have female priests, because of the fact that, you know, most of the people that actually are dedicated members of the Order of Exorcists are actually females. I would have a much larger staff if I could ordain some of my own female staff in this ministry, who are now, you know, lay members that help me out as volunteers. If I could ordain them to the priesthood, that would really make my life a lot easier and have more priests, and I'd be able to do more and expand the ministry more rapidly. But we can't do that because the Church of Rome has established within the limits of the sacramental theology that the sacrament of holy orders can only be conferred on a man, cannot be conferred on a woman. So we honor that, even though we would prefer they didn't have that rule until a apostolic council were to determine that the theology could be interpreted differently. We're adhering to the ancient structure. But married priesthood is not an issue because that's not part of sacramental theology. That is a preference that the Roman Catholic Church adopted. It's not necessary. In fact, the Orthodox churches have never had a celibate priesthood. They always had married priests. They still do to this day. The Roman Catholic Church used to have married priests all the way up to about 1200 years AD. It was only around the Middle Ages when they started to change that, and that's because the wives were inheriting the property of the church because of the way that the structure of the church was in those days, that the property was the legal, or I should say the priest, the pastor was the legal owner of that property of the church. And so when they would die, the wives would inherit the church, and then they would sell them and make money. And then the parish would be dissolved. And so the church was trying to avoid this legal problem back then of these priests' wives inheriting all of the wealth of the parish. And so the way they got around that was by just preventing priests from getting married. So it really had nothing to do with emulating Jesus or, seeing Jesus as some kind of it was all about money. And so
I'm shocked.
Orthodox Church never had any use for that. It's not terribly surprising when you think about it. But, the Orthodox Church never had any use for it. So they always had a married priesthood. They do have a celibate episcopacy. So bishops in the Orthodox Church are usually drawn from the monastics. And monastics are almost always, in almost every situation except for some of the more liberal sects, are almost always celibate. So in independent Catholicism, there's almost no celibate priests. We're almost all married. Even bishops are married. And I'm married myself.
That's interesting. I mean, it sounds like with your religion, it's more of a evolving belief system. Do you feel that the Roman Church are just too stuck on the old ways, or can they even think about changing with the times to get more people into the church?
Yeah, I mean, just being progressive,
It's a good question because, honestly, I think it's even more than just saying that they're too stuck in the old ways. I don't think they're stuck enough in the old ways, because the old ways, if you really want to get back to ancient Christianity, I mean, it's right there in the New Testament, where it states that a bishop is to be the man, is to be a is to have one wife. And obviously they're emphasizing the idea of not participating in a polygamous relationship, but the understanding that bishops would be married was just a given. Sometimes when you think about it, what happened was the church became very politicalized after the legalization of Christianity in about 300 AD, when Constantine sort of converted the entire Roman Empire over to Christianity as now the state religion. And then as that happened, Christianity grew in political and temporal power. And then they started to develop traditions that were very much based within this new cycle of religious operation, which had largely forgotten and left behind the ways of the ancient church, which happened, 100, 300, 200, 300 years earlier than this. And so I think if Rome went back to the way the church was when it was established under the apostles, they'd be much further ahead and far more progressive today than they are at the present time. And so this is actually one of the reasons why the Nicolaitan Catholic tradition was established, was to bring Catholicism back to its roots, to bring it back to that ancient tradition, that ancient church, where all of this legalism didn't have any relevance. It was always, it was about the sacraments. It was about salvation. It was about experiencing our relationship with Christ in whatever way that meant to, the ancients. And all of that is really there in the New Testament. The church, I think, deviated too much. And now that after that deviation, they don't want to go back to it. Right. So you know, it's just, it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult thing because, see, you know, the papacy also has this other aspect of it where once something is ruled, it is irreversible. So there's certain elements, ex cathedra, for example. Anytime the Pope speaks from the chair, which becomes an infallible statement, there's no reversing it. You know, because the entire theology is based on this idea that when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, he's speaking as if the Holy Spirit is speaking. And so the Holy Spirit wouldn't make a mistake. And so there would be never any reason to reverse an ex cathedra statement if you believe in that sort of thing. So the problem is that as the church has gotten much older, and now it's, you know, it's been in existence for 2,000 years, it's a long time to try to maintain a cohesive operation. And so I don't know if they can really make a progressive move. There's too much resistance. There's too many people within Catholicism itself that really are in sympathy with that more conventional conservative aspect. In fact, you know, a lot of Roman Catholics today are very unhappy with Pope Francis because they see him as way too progressive. And they see him as trying to change the sacred traditions that the church has held for 1,700 years.
Right.
And, you know, so it's a tough thing. So we just wanted to leave all that behind. We love the religion.
Good choice.
Obviously, we would call ourselves Catholic.
Right.
Good choice, yeah. Yeah. It has been.
Yeah. Now, let's get into some of this here. So I looked on your site, the Order of the Exorcist Atlanta, and I wanted to start here where it says your purpose is to make available to the general public a professional investigation protocol for demonic and paranormal activity. We serve the needs of anyone who may feel that they have a genuine demonic and or paranormal disturbance active within their family or within their home or family. So this is something that obviously draws intrigue from us and probably the general public and you know, paranormal activity and whatnot has been, you know, of people's interest and in people's minds and psyches for as long as I almost said as long as I could remember, but as long, you know, in folklore forever. It's very interesting to see that you guys, this is what you deal with. What is people's first reactions to this? Do you get a lot of people coming to you guys skeptic at first, or are people coming towards you you're the last line of help?
The skepticism is mostly from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's generally people who do not need help or are not seeking help. It's mostly people who either see me on television or hear me on the radio,
right,
and they just don't want to believe it. And so I'll sometimes get emails or I'll get hate mail from people in the public that saw something where I was on it, and then they will you know, criticize it, saying it's not real, and I've heard everything in the book.
Right.
But as far as the people that actually come to us for help, and we get on average about 4-5 cases a week.
Wow.
And we only actually work 2 cases a month. So as you can imagine, there's more cases, far more cases coming in than we're able to even get to.
Right.
We do call everybody though. We do like a pre-assessment over the telephone,
mm-hmm,
which gives us the opportunity to kind of really assess how severe the situation is, because sometimes these things can be resolved without the need to actually go there and conduct a thorough investigation. Sometimes it's just people who need to be pointed in the right direction. And so we do contact everyone who reaches us. One of my lead investigators, you know, that's why I have a team, because, you know, the volume is large. And we have a lot of cases coming in, and it's growing all the time. So there, you know, when we have a new client, there's never any apprehension typically. I mean, they're usually, by the time they reach us, they're so desperate that they're just grateful that there's somebody that's actually calling them back and taking them seriously.
Yeah.
So that's the good part about this work. And again, getting back to your original question, you know, about the Nicolaitan Church and, you know, whether or not we are under the Vatican. I mean, this is one of the primary reasons why it is advantageous for us to not be under the Vatican, because the Roman Catholic Church generally does not help people in this particular that are suffering from this particular problem, unless they are a Roman Catholic of long standing, in good standing with one of the parishes within the Roman Catholic Church. If you went to them as a Protestant or even as a Buddhist or Muslim, somebody that wasn't even Christian, they would most likely turn you away. There might be a few Catholic exorcists out there that are like myself, that are still within the Roman Catholic system, that make exceptions or try to work around the conventions of the system. But largely the system would be against those types of individuals. And we help everyone. It doesn't matter what religion they are. It doesn't matter what they believe. We will help all of them. They might not like what they have to do to fix the problem, because it's right. Not a magic wand. You know, I tell people all the time, I'm not Gandalf the Grey. You know, I'm not Dumbledore with a magic wand.
Oh, damn it.
I go in there.
That's who we thought we had on.
I was going to ask him a question about Hermione.
You know, a lot of people think that's what it is, though. They think, you know, we come in here, we say some incantation, and then the problem just magically goes away. Now, sometimes it does. I mean, sometimes there are little, you know, we call them minor miracles, where the case is resolvable, you know, almost immediately. That does happen. It actually happens more often than you might think. But, you know, in more often than not, particularly the very serious cases, it's a process. And 75 to 80% of that process is up to the client. It's up to the client to make changes to their lives, where the priest or the exorcist and the exorcist team are just facilitators to help that individual make those modifications, to help give them the grace and power of the church for the period of time that they need it, so that they can overcome some of the adversity that they're experiencing on a spiritual level. So, you know, it's a lot different than what people think. And that's part of the reason why I do television and radio as frequently as I'm asked, because I like to educate people as to the authenticity of this work. I want people to realize that there is a place you can go to get help. And while, you know, we are getting more cases than we can solve because we just don't have the manpower to reach everybody, we do try our best. And like I said, we do call everyone back. So you will get some kind of help. It might not be as much as you need or as much as you'd like, but we will do everything within our resources to do everything that we can for everyone that calls us.
Now, what kind of signs are you looking for when you're doing these investigations? Is it what led up to these people acting possessed? Is there certain things that they say? What are, like, key signs you kind of look into?
Well, I mean, the first step is to just make sure that we're not dealing with mental illness. I mean, that's
what I was
going to
ask you. Yeah, that was on my list of questions. So, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, sure, I understand. I mean, you know, mental illness and demonic possession have a certain comorbid relationship. You know, there's no way from the in the initial stages of an investigation that you really can tell the difference between the two, unless the signs and symptoms are so obvious that you know, it's easier to make such a determination. But most of the time, it's more subtle than that. And like I said, nobody who is suffering from a genuine demonic attack or a demonic event is going to be without psychological and emotional consequences, which will show up as anxieties, depressions, even a psychosis. Sometimes, believe it or not, a psychosis can coexist with demonic possession, which would, as you can imagine, make it very difficult to determine what the causation is. So that's number one, trying to assess their psychiatric and medical history to see if there's some type of neurological history that would reveal certain symptoms that may mimic demonic possession, but is actually medical. And then, of course, you know, various types of psychoses, whether it be schizophrenia or even bipolar, you know, these are all possibilities. But the things that are sort of the telltale signs of demonic possession that we look for, you know, and sometimes we are lucky enough to see it in the beginning so that we don't have to go through a lengthy investigative process. That is number one, I would say, is the ability to speak in languages that they never studied.
Wow.
That's a big one, because there's no mental illness that causes a person to have that happen to them.
You've seen this on.
Oh, yes.
Really? Wow.
Yes. We have absolutely seen it. I have a client who, in fact, right now, one that we've worked with, we're working with, who his background is basically just a country boy in the South. I mean, he does not have anything beyond a junior high education, and he is able to speak. When he gets into these states of full possession, he's able to speak fluently in Latin.
Are you bummed?
And we've even heard.
Are you disappointed where it's not a language that you know? Like, do you have to bring in like a translator?
Well, what we do is we record it, and yes, I mean, I have. If it's not a language I recognize, then we, you know, bring in other scholars who are linguists.
That's incredible.
Or whoever we might need.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, he's even able to speak Aramaic. I mean, it's really quite fascinating. I've heard Sanskrit before.
These are
people, you know, that don't have a scholarly education. I don't know too many Americans that can speak Sanskrit. I mean, I really don't. You know, it's
Go ahead.
You know, the possession of inhuman strength is another one. You know, that's a more common one than the languages even. But, you know, we have seen 12-year-old girls be able to knock off 5 grown men who are holding her down.
Jesus.
You know, ugh. Remarkable things like that. So these are things that, you know, you don't write off to mental illness. These are things where you start to take the claims of demonic possession more seriously. There is also some of the most, I guess you could say, the most radical or dramatic symptoms would be levitation. And my team has not seen that yet, but I have personally seen a person levitate off their bed, and it's quite a sight to see. I mean, it's not as high up as you see in the movies where they go to the ceiling. That doesn't happen that I've seen. I mean, maybe it's happened at some point with some other case, but none of the ones I've witnessed. But I have seen them levitate a good foot and a half off the bed. And, you know, these are things that you can't write off to mental illness.
No. I mean, I got so many questions for you. Like, when you are going into a scenario like this, someone who is possessed or someone who's dealing with these disturbances, what is your mindset? Now, obviously, you're there to help, first and foremost. But, I mean, the normal person hears this and, you know, like I'm hearing you talk about a girl fighting off 5 guys and the hair on my neck standing up. Is the fear and adrenaline pumping, or have you been through this so much that you're able to keep a clear head and do what you actually have to do?
You know, I always keep a clear head, and some of it is actually my secular training. You know, my secular degree is in psychology. So, you know, I worked in the clinical setting. I used to work in lockdown facilities with extremely mentally ill patients that generally the only patients I saw either had schizophrenia or bipolar. Most of the ones that I had were extreme bipolar with a criminal background history. And so they were usually admitted to the lockdown facility under court order because of something that they did, usually a violent act. You know, I had excrement thrown at my face. I've had every possible thing you can imagine, you know, happen to me in these lockdown facilities. So you grow a pretty thick skin from that, where to the point that when I go into now dealing with the other side of this type of phenomena, where now I'm dealing with more of the spiritual causation instead of the mental causation, although I would actually argue philosophically that that the line is so thin, it probably doesn't even really matter when you get to a certain point. The reality is that being anxious or feeling fear is not efficacious. It doesn't help you. It does not help them. So what we do is we just keep our focus on the end goal. And so the goal is to always heal the patient. The goal is to heal the victim. The goal is to get them to back to normalcy, to bring them out of this condition of torment. And that becomes the driving force. And so there's very little that can distract me from that purpose. And fear just isn't part of that equation.
Now, these people are being possessed, the spirits itself. How do we define these spirits? Are we considering them just evil? Are they from specifically hell? Is it specifically somebody who passed on to the afterlife and possessing in our body?
You know, that's an excellent, excellent question that I wish more people would really talk about. Because, see, Christianity has done a bit of a disservice, particularly in the modern day, because a lot of these modern variations of Christianity, like, you know, you can be evangelical churches now, you have these fundamentalist churches, they're now teaching they're preaching to their congregations this idea that if it's not of God, it's of Satan. And so the idea here is that anything paranormal that is harming an individual has got to be demonic. And by demonic, they mean satanic. And the reality of it is, anybody who does this work at a professional level like we do, where this is all we deal with mostly, I mean, Nicolaitan Church started out as a teaching ministry. It sort of became a paranormal investigation and demonic resolution ministry out of necessity, because people were coming to us, they didn't have anywhere else to turn, and now we started focusing so much of our attention on doing that the teaching ministry became a lesser issue. And so we still do it, but it's just not at the front of the ministry anymore. Now it's this. And so we, you know, anybody who does this work professionally is going to tell you that the majority of what is being called demonic is not satanic. That is a different category. So our group has actually identified four specific categories of demons. And only the first category is what we would call satanic, and that would be the fallen angels. These are those that are in league with Satan. And so, you know, these are the rebellious angels that turned against God, and now their fundamental drive is to destroy his creation. And we're the primary target, because we are, in the Judeo-Christian worldview, humanity is the epitome of God's creation, because we are the very image of God, which nothing else in creation can say that. And when you consider how marvelous the universe is, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, theologically speaking, we're the ones that get that privilege to be called in the image of God. And of course, he's not talking about physical. I mean, we're not talking about that God has a head, two arms, two legs, and, you know, is walking around as a human being somewhere in some other dimension. No, I mean, we're talking about the essence of what makes us what we are, that we get that privilege to be co-creators, that we have creative powers, that we can create, you know, out of our own very essence. And so, you know, that's a special thing. And the demonic, the satanic realm wants to destroy that. So that's the primary thing that we're looking for, because that's the most serious and that's the most usually the most destructive form of demonic attack. And that's the one that everyone equates to demonic attack. That's obviously the one that you always see in the movies. But it's not true. It's that's like that is the least likely possibility.
Hmm.
That is the most rare is a satanic attack. Most of the time, it is going to fall into one of the other three categories. And so the other three categories, we call them demons because they are harmful to human beings when you come in contact with these things. But they are not true demons in the sense of a fallen angel or a satanic creature. So the second category is the most common, and that is what we call elementals. We also sometimes refer to them as primordial spirits. These are entities that predate humanity. They actually predate this planet. They were part of the initial energy of creation itself. So these are ancient forces, billions of years old. Is part of the universe itself. They are almost entirely non-corporeal. So, you know, unless a person is sensitive in some way, we're not going to know that they're there. We can't sense them with our five senses typically, unless the activity is extremely strong and it gets to the point where people start to sense the presence of something else there. But what they are is essentially just parts of nature, parts of the non-corporeal side of the universe, the part that's not physical. And most of the universe is not physical. You know, we only get to see the parts that are. We only pay attention to the parts that are. But the majority of the universe is actually non-physical, or what we could say is the spiritual world. And I like to tell people, you know, spiritual world is not somewhere out there. It's not in another dimension. It's not some other reality. It's part of the universe. It's just the non-physical part, the part that the five senses do not have an immediate connection to. And so there's all a plethora of different types of elementals. Some of them are benign to human beings. You know, they go completely unnoticed. Some are fairly neutral, but if you come into contact with them in a direct way, it can cause a type of spiritual illness that could lead to what we would classify as an attachment, where they feed off of you. But the majority of elementals, you know, if you were trying to measure them on an intellectual scale, are a little more than mosquitoes. So, you know, it's like when a mosquito bites you, it's going to cause usually an itchy reaction. They're parasites, essentially sucking your blood for their own survival, feeding off of your energy. And some of them carry disease, so they can make you sick. And so, elementals are sort of like spiritual mosquitoes, most of them anyway, the ones that cause harm to us. And, you know, a mosquito is not trying to be malevolent. He's not trying to harm you. He's just doing what his nature has him doing for his own survival. And these elementals do that to us. So they're all over the place. If you happen to build your house in a location that has a lot of these types of elementals, then you can sometimes have a problem where we would need to come in and help you get rid of it. So that's the primary thing that we see as elementals. But there's two other categories that I'll briefly mention. There's created demons, and then there's wrathful spirits. Created demons are thought forms, and these would be ones that would be more likened to witchcraft or ceremonial magic, magic with the K, you know, occultism, where a person would conjure a demonic entity to inflict harm on another. Various types of incantations. There's grimoires from the Middle Ages that have dozens and dozens of spells of how you can cause harm spiritually by performing acts of witchcraft or magic. And so these are not Satan. This is not conjuring a fallen angel. This is conjuring a thought form, which is a malicious creation of your own psychic ability projected outward towards a target. But for all intents and purposes, it behaves like an actual entity, and it becomes sentient for the period of time that it's operating. So you have to treat it as though it is
a sentient being, because for the time that it exists, it is sentient, and it will definitely try to outsmart you, and in many cases it can if you're not careful. So that's one that we see a lot with curses, particularly when a person is suffering from having a curse placed on them. And that's a big part of our ministry, too. We get a lot of people that fall into that category. And then lastly, there's wrathful spirits, and this is what we would consider to be classic hauntings. These are the spirits of the dead who did not die well. Usually they died traumatically. They died in a state of fear. They died in a state of panic. They died unexpectedly. Usually car accidents, heart attacks can cause this. Anytime a person is not prepared to enter into those stages of death, in other words, you know, if they don't know that, if you have a terminal illness, you have time to prepare. It's not a pleasant experience, I'm sure, but you have time to actually set things in order and know that it's coming. And even prepare yourself philosophically or spiritually if necessary. Whereas, you know, a person getting, you know, getting into rush hour to go to work who gets hit by somebody, a truck or something, and dies instantly is not necessarily prepared or thinking that, oh, this is it. You know, this is my last voyage in this car. This is my last hour on this earth. And so sometimes when a person is not prepared, knocks them out of alignment spiritually. And what a lot of people, again, don't fully understand about that process is that when we die, we lose the faculties of our brain. The brain stays with the body. The brain is part of the body. The brain rots away and decomposes with the rest of the corpse. It doesn't go with you. And your brain is where your consciousness is. That is your consciousness. It is the electrical activity of your brain. So your spiritual side, that non-corporeal part of yourself that is connected to that non-corporeal part of the universe that we talked about earlier, that is intimately connected to the faculties of awareness that is intrinsic to the universe itself as one of its fundamental properties. This is where consciousness essentially comes from, is the fact that awareness itself is a property of the universe. And so that awareness becomes instinctual at that point. So if you die in a state of fear, you become fear. If you die in a state of hatred because maybe you were murdered and, you know, the last thing you saw was your murderer killing you, then, you know, if you had great anger at that moment before you died, then anger is what you become. Wow. And so you become a spirit that we would call wrathful. And you will behave, because there is no more. Again, you're not making logical decisions. That died with you, with your brain. All you have left is instinct. And so you become typically something that would be no different than an evil spirit or a demon, for lack of a better word. And you can attach to people, feed off of people, make people sick, and even possess. And so we always have to discern which of those four categories are we dealing with, because each of those four categories has a different type of solution.
Wow. We didn't get any of that. Can you say that answer? No.
You mean that third thing. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, so what are the most common signs that something's going, like, does a family generally come to you about a child or a relative? What are they experiencing? Is it them talking? Is it voices and whatnot? And I also, piggybacking to that, I wanted to say, are people more susceptible to these kind of possessions by something they're doing, or is it where they're living, or is a lot of times are they just kind of innocent victims that this happens to? Like, is it someone's behavior or something they're messing with that might open them up to this, or is it just kind of a coincidence?
Well, to your second question there, it's all the above. I mean, anyone could be a target. Anyone at any time could be a target. But how you fare after you are targeted will determine the outcome based upon what you're doing. So there's nothing that you can do that's going to make you necessarily more of a target, other than the fact that the demonic tends to, and it doesn't matter which of the four categories, they all do it the same way.
the demonic tends to seek the path of least resistance, and so it tends to target those that are the most susceptible or the easiest to subdue. And so a person who is living a sinful life, a person who is not spiritually protected, a person who is not practicing spiritual cultivation within a religious system or even something that they might be even doing on their own at home, you know, is going to be more vulnerable just out of virtue of the fact that they're an easier target. Okay. But that being said, they're not always the best victim, because if you are being targeted by, let's say, a satanic demon, an atheist is not a great prize for you, because what are you winning? You're not taking somebody away from God. You're just taking somebody who doesn't believe anyway. So that person's already, as far as Satan is concerned, Satan's already won that one, because there's nothing to gain from it. So generally the satanic demons are looking for those who are the most devout. They're looking for the ones that are going to church every Sunday. They're looking for those that are praying every night. But they're also looking for those who are still the spiritually the weakest, perhaps because of some great sin that they're committing that they don't, you know, that they would rather sweep under the carpet. Sometimes it could be psychological illness or emotional illness. Maybe somebody very close to them died and they never got over the loss, and they're still in mourning. And so that depression can sometimes bring in the demonic. Drug use can bring in the demonic, because it alters our consciousness to be more susceptible to the non-corporeal world, which is essentially the origin of a lot of hallucinogens and how hallucinations go hand in hand with some of these drugs. That's why, you know, some shamans utilize some of these psychoactive chemicals in their rituals so that they can interact with the spiritual world. But of course, they're doing it in a controlled way. A person who's looking at it as a recreational benefit is really sort of abusing the substance instead of using it ritually, and so therefore it's even more dangerous to interact with these types of spirits without the benefit of the guidance of a shaman or someone who actually knows what they're doing. So these are all factors that can make somebody more risky. But to your first question, you know, what brings how do people contact us and what state they're in, I would say it's about 30%. It's a family member who is seeking help for a family member who is now past the point where they're even thinking they can be helped. And so it's usually a family member who feels that the family member who's being afflicted has reached a point where they're not even seeking help anymore. And that's when we come in. And then I'd say 70% are people who feel that something is attacking them and they're not sure what. They're having a lot of paranormal types of experiences and they want reassurance, either reassurance that it's not paranormal, or they want us to come in and get rid of it for them because they feel that some kind of invisible entity is wreaking havoc on their life. So it's about a 70% that, 30% calling in from another another location or another family member, something of that nature.
Are you able to have conversations with these spirits? I know you're saying they talked like Latin or Sanskrit. Now, if you get a translator, are you able to like talk with them and maybe discuss or kind of negotiate or in any way?
Yes, that is very possible. Typically we never needed a translator because, you know, if you're dealing with a very high level demonic entity, particularly something that is in the category of a fallen angel, then they will speak to you in your own language. And so you can engage them, although it is not typically something that we do for long periods of time. It's only for the purposes of trying to get the demon's name. or to assist us in trying to find out how and when they entered into the victim. But, you know, they will, a demon will be all too happy to engage you in conversation, irrelevant conversation. They like to expose your sins. They like to, because see, a lot of people ask me this question, can demons read our thoughts? You know, how do they know so much about us? The short answer is no, they cannot read your thoughts, but they are very astute and patient observers, and they will sometimes sit and watch and follow their victims for years, watching for their weaknesses. Jeez. Trying to determine, you know, when it, what they can do in order to strike. And so exorcists, because we are always under the, you know, on the radar, we're always being, you know, we're always interacting with these things, so they very much almost always know us. You know, they will usually call us out by name when we come into a particular household with that type of demonic entity inside. You know, then they've been watching us. And so the sins that we commit become very well known to them because they're watching everything that we do. And they try to use that against us to convince us that we're too weak to fight them, or that we're too sinful. We're not worthy to do this work. We're not worthy to be priests. We can't be representatives of Jesus Christ because we're so sinful ourselves. And so how do we expect to be able to, you know, help others when we're not even able to defeat the sins within us? You know, so they try to use these little spiritual manipulative games to discourage us and weaken us ourselves. So it's very important to maintain as close a life to holiness as one can. And so being an exorcist is not for every priest. It just isn't. Mm-hmm. And you don't go into priesthood to become an exorcist. You know, the exorcist finds you. It finds the right priest when the time is right.
Now, as we're winding down here, one of the things I'm sure a lot of people are curious about, I know I am, what types of things rid person of being possessed? What kinds of cures are there? Or I don't know if cure is even the word you would use, but what are some things that an exorcist would use or do to help rid someone of a demon? And if you could break it down into layman terms for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Another great question. You know, the thing is, exorcism is last resort.
Okay.
So we are going to proceed to an exorcism as the very last thing when everything else that we have tried has failed. So the first thing we like to do, particularly with like hauntings or where the disturbances tend to be more environmental, more like what we would see in a demonic infestation versus, you know, a specific attack on a human being. We like to start with blessings of the house. So the first step almost always is going to be to bless the house with a solemn blessing. And then if the family members are being affected, then we give them a solemn blessing. We see how they respond to that. In many, many cases, if it's just a demonic interference, or if it's, you know, a demonic obsession, perhaps one of the weaker stages of demonic attack, then the solemn blessing in many cases fixes it. It might take a few of them, but it eventually it weakens the hold and the demonic attachment just dissipates and breaks away, and then they can go back to living a fairly normal life. Now, there's sometimes a healing process depending upon how badly they were affected, but in many cases, that's enough. Then the next step, you know, if that didn't work, the next step is to get more serious with the blessing of the environment, and that would be a sealing of the property where we go in and we actually consecrate the ground and make the ground holy ground so that it becomes very difficult for an evil presence to remain within that boundary. It actually starts to weaken them so that we have a better hold on getting rid of them a little further down the road if necessary. And then, so that would be like our step two. Our third step at this point, if that didn't work, is unction. And sometimes I will go do the solemn blessing and I'll go right into unction, which is the sacrament of the sick or the sacrament of holy anointing. It is where we have every chrism mass on the morning of Holy Thursday during Holy Week, the week before Easter. The bishops of all the churches will consecrate the three holy oils of chrism, catechumens, and the oil of the sick. And the oil of the sick is what we use in this sacrament, which is a special healing ointment. In substance, it's just extra virgin olive oil and nothing else. But but it's been charged, it's been consecrated in a way at this special mass that only occurs once a year. And sometimes a priest can be authorized to consecrate more if he runs out in the field, but typically you don't do that. You almost always have it from that previous mass, and we lay on hands and call the Holy Spirit down into that individual. And this sacrament has a remarkable power to heal them spiritually first, then mentally and emotionally second. And sometimes it can even permeate into their physical being and heal physical disorders. But that's, you know, spiritual healing is primarily what it's there for. And so this combined with a solemn blessing is usually what fixes 80 to 90% of the cases we see, never having even needing to resort to an exorcism. The next step up from that would be a minor exorcism. And that is sort of the a shorter form of exorcism that, you know, the church employs when needed. It's actually, it uses it for baptism. We will sometimes do all the Catholic churches, I shouldn't say sometimes, all the Catholic churches will perform an exorcism, a minor exorcism, prior to baptizing someone. That's part of the rite of baptism. Other denominations don't always do that, unfortunately. But that's another stage. And then if all of that has failed and the problem is still very much there and we've determined that it is a genuine demonic attack, that's when we will start the preparations for solemn exorcism. And that's what you will see, you know, that's what you see on television. That's what you see in the movies.
And do you find the things in the movies are what we see, is it similar to actually what really goes on, or is it completely false? And also, does anybody go uncured?
Your first question, it's similar to the movies. I would say the movies exaggerate it.
Right.
You know, there's a series on TV right now, which is it's sort of like a spin-off series of the Exorcist movies. And I've been watching a little bit of it, and that is very sensationalized. It's nothing like that. But you know, as far as the vomiting, the levitation, the welts that appear that spell words or have symbols, all of that does happen. It doesn't happen in every case, but it does happen in the most extreme cases. But I've never seen a person's head spin all the way around. They will start to look sick, but they don't typically start to look monstrous like you see. Although there have been cases where a person gets so ill because they've been afflicted for so long that they can start to look almost like take on sort of a horrific zombie type look that can be quite disturbing to see. But not to the effect of what you saw in, like, you know, Linda Blair in The Exorcist. That's a bit of an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. As far as your second question, remind me again what you asked.
I was saying, does anybody ever go uncured where the exorcism doesn't work and
uncured?
Yeah, you know, where they just,
there are.
Sorry, go ahead.
You know, No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Exorcism is a process,
okay,
as I said at the beginning. And so, you know, sometimes we can cure a person on the first night. Sometimes it takes days. Sometimes it takes weeks. Sometimes it takes months. And in rare cases, it can take years. And so, again, the prognosis depends upon the fortitude of the victim. How willing is the victim to follow our instructions? How closely will they follow our instructions to the point that they do what they need to do to get better? I liken it this way. This is the perfect analogy. An exorcist is like a spiritual surgeon. Okay, he comes in with his staff, and we are there to remove a malignancy. Okay, so we come in, and so the demon is like a tumor. We come in, we remove the tumor. But after the surgery, you have to give that patient aftercare instructions. Otherwise, they could risk infection. They might need a change of lifestyle because maybe something they were doing is what led to them getting a malignant tumor in the first place. And so, you know, they might need to change their eating habits. They might need to quit smoking. And if a person refuses to do those things, then, you know, their prognosis, despite the surgery, is that there's going to be a likely reoccurrence, or they're never going to really get entirely better. Hmm. And so, you know, I have never seen a case that was not solvable. I have seen cases where people walk away and give up. But there's never been a case that I have come up against where I said, "This we can't fix this. The grace of the church isn't strong enough for this one. We're going to have to let this one die." Oh. We've never had that.
Well, that's good.
But we've had people that want... Yeah, it's very good. But we have had people that, you know, were expecting me to come in with Gandalf's staff and, you know, just knock this demon off of them, and then, you know, they go back to work the next day. It, you know, that just doesn't happen. And so they can sometimes get very frustrated with the process aspect because they don't want to change their life. They don't want to start going back to church. They don't want to go and receive the Eucharist. They don't want to go to confession. And these are all the things that can heal them, and they don't want that. And so, you know, you can't force a person to accept God into their life. That has to be willingly chosen. And if a person refuses it, there's nothing the exorcist can do beyond making that available to them.
Well, got you. I mean, what you're describing here is so amazing and intense. I got to ask you, dealing with all these amazing things and the creepiness about it, is there anything on earth that you're afraid of? Like, would we be surprised to find out that you're scared of mice or something like that?
Spiders.
you know, I don't really have many fears. You know, I would say if I have any fear at all, any phobia at all, I would say it's probably of getting into like a getting hit by like a drunk driver or being in an accident that was completely outside of my control. Mm. I sometimes have a little anxiety about that when I really think about it too much. Like, I mean, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. The drivers here are crazy. Maybe not as bad as Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles was pretty bad when I used to live out there. But I mean, honestly, it's pretty bad here in Atlanta. And you know, so sometimes when you're driving on the road and you're seeing people do such crazy stuff, the thought does cross my mind that, boy, I really hope nobody hits me one of these days, you know, when I'm driving to the supermarket or, you know, wherever it is that I'm going. But, you know, I don't know if that even classifies as a fear because it's not something that debilitates me in any way. It's just sort of a passing thought that occurs to me. But, no, I don't really have, like, I don't really fear, you know, animals or insects or anything like that. And I don't really have any phobias about anything of the spiritual side of things, and no matter how dark. It's just, you know, again, it's all about getting the work done. And if I had too many phobias about it, I wouldn't be very useful. Sort of like getting back to my surgical analogy. If, you know, a surgeon's no good if they're afraid of blood. Mm. You know, if they get queasy at the sight of blood, they're not going to be a very effective surgeon. So it kind of falls into that category.
Awesome. So if people want to check out your work or even get information on what you do or the Nicolaitan Church in general, where can they go? And second question, what if your co-host, like, you catch him every once in a while talking to himself in, like, the bathroom and making weird accents and voices? Is there a chance that he might be possessed too?
Probably not.
Okay.
Probably not. You know, I think you're probably okay.
Well, I have your number now.
But if you do. But if an object flies across the room in front of you while he's doing it, then you might want to give me a call for sure.
All right, you know what I mean? I'll keep an eye on it.
If people want to reach me, honestly, the very best way is to just go to www.nicolean.org. That's NICHOLEAN.org. You could also go to esotericcatholic.org. Goes to the same website. And there is a section on that website. If you look at the menu at the top right corner of the page, you will see a section where it says request an investigation, and you can click that, and that's the intake form for getting help. So no matter what, even if you were to call us, I mean, you can call us. You know, we've got an outreach number and we've got the main line. It's all on the website. But even if you call us, you're still going to have to fill out that intake form, because that's how we start a case. That's how we open a case. And so the best way to reach us, the quickest way to reach us, is to fill out that form. And then a lead investigator on my team will usually contact you within 48 to 72 hours. Sometimes it can take up to a week if we have high volume that week. But in most cases, we shoot to try to get to you, you know, in about a couple of days. And then they'll start the pre-assessment process and find out more about what's going on. But keep in mind, you know, in order to really, for us to come out to your house and to do a thorough investigation and to really start to work a thorough resolution, we are a triage system. So we take the most severe cases first. It is not first come, first serve. It is the most severe cases first, and then we work our way down. And like I said, we get five cases a week. So, you know, it's very hard to get to some of the ones on the bottom of the queue.
Right.
But if you're patient, you never know. And sometimes if a client that we have booked cancels, then we try to fill that spot, and we'll just keep going down the list until we get to somebody who's available that day. So sometimes you get lucky. So it's always worth filling out an intake form and letting a lead investigator start a case with you, and then at least you have somebody that you can talk to. And if things get worse, then we can move your case up if needed.
Awesome. Brian, thank you so much. It's really cool how open you are and how informative you are in what you do, because people don't get to hear that side of this at all. And it's definitely something that we all hear about and wonder about, and there is a mystique to it, obviously, but
I mean, it's amazing to call him a laid-back bishop exorcist.
You are the most laid-back bishop exorcist I've ever met.
Yep, true.
Brian, thanks so much, and good luck with everything you got going on, and hope to talk to you soon.
Absolutely, anytime. Thank you so much, you guys. Take care.
Pretty wild, man. It's amazing, like just the things people do in this world, you know, like whether it's a job or a calling or. But I don't believe him about you.
No, he's an expert, so you know I'm not possessed.
I'm going to start sending emails to them like my client is extreme, like just put all the symptoms and see if they acknowledge it. Like, okay, we'll come out and check him out.
He keeps on saying lines from Dukes of Hazzard for no reason.
This has to be a possession.
He did a coy Duke reference. Come on now. He's got to be possessed.
That's way more weird than Sanskrit. But all right. Berlew.
That's who I am.
What you got?
Well, as you know, as I'm going through the month, I've been doing my pumpkin spice whatever.
Pumpkin spice whatever.
And I've been doing with the lovely Miss Isabel here. We were making ourselves a pumpkin spice couple, you know?
Yeah, we never talked about that, the pumpkin couple. How did this happen?
It was just, she was on the couch when I was recording an episode. That's kind of what I figured. And, you know, we were playing around and say, all right, there's some stuff here and more comments coming along. It's like, all right, we can do a couple thing. And then Callie would just, every time we had food, want to come in. So she was the pumpkin spice pooch. And We just label everything pumpkin spice whatever, you know.
It's cute.
I know
it's
it
really
is.
Really adorable.
I know. We're a lovely couple.
You're so adorable.
But Scott, I felt bad. You know why?
Why?
Because I wasn't including you stuff.
What a guy.
So I didn't want to just grab anything pumpkin spice from Trader Joe's and bring it to you.
Right.
You're my buddy here. I wanted to make you a pumpkin spice meal.
A pumpkin spice meal. Yeah. Okay.
And I went to the new level on this one. I didn't just say, let's pumpkin spice stuff. I said, let's pumpkin stuff.
Okay. Let's pumpkin it up.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have three things here for you.
Three?
Yes.
All right. Well, this is good because I didn't get a chance to cook a pumpkin thing. So yeah. This is good.
Yeah. So let me.
Have you tried these things?
I have not. So we're both going to be a part of this experiment. Here.
Okay.
So I want to start off with an appetizer. First off, nothing but the best yellow rounds from the dollar store I could pick up.
Yellow rounds?
Yeah, that's all you need to know.
So they're just like tortilla chips.
Yeah, pretty much, but what would you use it?
Yellow
tortilla
rounds.
Chips.
I like how they just totally gave up on the name. It's yellow, it's round, package it, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what we dip it into but punk-a-mole.
Punk-a-mole.
Yes.
Okay, so why don't you explain how you did this?
Well, I made a regular batch of guacamole.
Okay.
With avocados, onion, tomato, lime juice.
Uh-huh.
And I have two containers here. One has, what I did was I pureed a pumpkin. I literally bought a pumpkin, cooked it, and pureed it.
I hope you filmed that.
No, I didn't.
You should have.
I should have, specifically because it took freaking forever and it pissed off the lady. Like, literally, it took up a quarter of Sunday doing that. And the other one...
Listen, if she's this pumpkin spice couple. She needs to understand this.
Well, we had a pumpkin spice argument that day.
It was a little spicy. She got a little spicy.
She got pumpkin spicy with me, Scott.
Pain in your nutmegs?
Yeah. Oh. Hackalator, what are you doing?
I was just
going
to cue up his laugh. I mean, no. Okay.
So we have two here. One is the pumpkin puree. The other one, I got pumpkin pie filling.
So there's two punk-a-moles.
Yeah.
Wow. This is serious.
This is, we went all out for this one.
Okay.
And the pumpkin pie one actually has like nutmeg and pumpkin spice and vanilla in it.
All right, well, let's do this together. We got to remember we're on audio here, so let's try to. Here's your yellow round.
I'm trying to balance it on my knees. It's not working out too well. Do we have enough space here?
Yeah, we can figure this out. All right. So here's your yellow round.
Yep. That's a puree. That's a pie.
All right. Let's start with this one. Here the greenish one. You should also take pictures of these.
Yeah. I'm going to take pictures of all of these.
Okay. All right. So I'm dipping in. So this is like normal avocado, but with pumpkin in it.
Yeah. Normal guacamole.
Oh, boy.
But we got pumpkin puree in this one.
What are you expecting from this?
I'm not really sure, to be honest.
Should you be doing, like, a pumpkin spice whatever?
I may do it tonight. circumstances, you know. Well, maybe be doing a double tomorrow, but we'll see.
We should always just film this.
Nope.
All right. Well, let's try this out.
All right. On three.
One, two, three.
Not tasting anything pumpkin-wise with a puree.
I feel like it tastes like guacamole with a little like pie crust in it.
It doesn't have any pie crust in it. It's just literally a purified pumpkin.
In this?
Yeah.
Let me try to get another bite here. Yep, tastes like guacamole, man.
Yeah, not adding anything to it. Now, this one is the pumpkin pie filling.
And it looks like dog food. Like when Obi throws up, when Obi throws up, this is exactly what it looks like all over the rug.
All
right. Does your dog throw up randomly?
Callie, I've never seen her throw up.
Oh,
wow. So
yeah, Obi will throw up like just randomly all the time. All right, so you're digging. This is pumpkin. So
pumpkin pie with pumpkin with pumpkin spice.
I feel like this one might be
with
more
vanilla.
Oh boy,
yeah,
vanilla and guacamole go together like
vanilla and guacamole. One, two.
Oh, it definitely smells like it. All right. Oh God. It kind of has a spoiled milk thing going on here. It's, oh, God.
It's definitely taken away from the guacamole. This is not going to be the next Halloween speciality.
Yeah, this is not going to be in, like, Essential Living magazine. Like, you got a recipe for the spice up your holidays.
I mean, it has the perfect name for it. We just got to get the recipe going.
Oh, God. That one's got a rough aftertaste, too. All right, well, guacamole.
I mean, it's pretty much...
First one tasted guacamole. Second one, like I said, it reminded me of, like, a, like ever, like, drink milk when it, like, curdled a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. All right.
All right. So... Now that we've had our appetizers, Scott, we got to get to the main course.
You should totally be videotaping this for an episode.
We can do that. But I kind of took the idea when you kind of thought of the item. And we have two meatloafs here, Scott.
Okay.
Pumpkin loaves.
Pumpkin loaves.
On one side, we have the pumpkin puree. On the other, we have all the ingredients from the pumpkin pie.
All right, make sure you, you take a picture of these things.
All
right. So we can post them on social media.
Yeah.
All right, so which one are we trying first?
I think this is the regular puree on the left.
It actually smells good. The smell coming out of this container, it smells good.
I make a decent meatloaf.
I've tried your meatloaf.
Yeah.
All right. So this is the pumpkin puree.
I believe so.
All right, here we go.
It makes it moist, I will say that.
It's not bad. It's definitely not bad.
It adds a little to it, but I think pumpkin doesn't have a huge flavor to it.
You know what it is? You're 100% right on that, because even like most of your pumpkin beers that you drink, are not really pumpkin flavor. It's more cinnamon and nutmeg and stuff like that that you are associating with pumpkin.
Yeah.
But actual pumpkin is pretty like squash and gourd tasting. So, all right. Mm-hmm. All right. Not terrible.
Not terrible. On this side, again, pumpkin, nutmeg, cinnamon, vanilla.
All right.
Not noticing a big difference, I gotta be honest.
No.
I figured there'd be like a huge difference.
Like,
with it
I could
being
eat
meat.
That.
Yeah.
In fact, it's kind of good.
Yeah. There we go.
Well, and I haven't eaten dinner either, so
yeah. That is true.
Mm. Yeah, not bad.
Yeah. So pumpkin can work with meatloaf.
Pumpkin can work with meatloaf.
Who the funk it?
I wonder if you took the outside of the meatloaf and like crusted it. In like pumpkin flavor, that might really work. You know what I mean?
It might be an experiment at the end of the month.
You know what I mean? Like, so the outside is like all pumpkin-y.
Yeah, I could totally do.
Instead
that.
Of maybe like inside the meat, it's like the outside covering of it.
All right,
not bad. First one was a little texture was a little weird, and then second one kind of tastes like a meatloaf.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So
dessert.
Well, everybody does dessert, Scott, with pumpkins.
Right.
And I didn't want to be that boring here.
Right.
So I was trying to think of what would add to a good meal. It would be a nice drink.
A drink?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, boy. Oh, God.
You want to figure out what's in here?
All right. I am holding a green jar of death.
I juiced a pumpkin.
You juiced? Oh, I see a pumpkin seed floating on the top of it.
Now,
it's very orange. The container also makes it look a little toxic because it looks like kind of like the poison jar.
Uh-huh.
So So
it was the first thing I grabbed at the dollar store. Now, we can do a straight pumpkin juice, or we can make this a nightcap.
With some Tito's.
Or coconut rum.
Well, I say we do both. I say we take it straight.
All right.
And then we take it without it. So what do we do? Just sip right from the jar here?
I mean, unless I can grab cups if you got some.
All right. Yeah, I'll go get cups.
All right.
Keep talking. Tell us the process of this drink.
So the drink itself, I want to say it is a freaking bitch to cut up a pumpkin for any kind of cooking whatsoever. I literally, I probably took about 6 hours on Sunday setting up these guacamoles and this meatloaf and stuff like that. Like, for starters, a pumpkin takes about an hour to cook in the oven, so it's not an easy thing. And then I overestimated how much pumpkin came out, so I actually like threw in the woods like a huge vat of pumpkin puree for the animals out there.
I can't wait till you have a bear. Just
Scott, Jack the bear, he wants new pumpkin spice, whatever.
Our worlds are colliding. All right, so we're going to try straight pumpkin juice.
Yep.
Now, you would think over the years someone would have invented pumpkin juice already, so maybe the reason they haven't is because of what you were saying, that a pumpkin is ridiculous to juice.
Well, I mean, it's hard to do it. I'm smelling it. It's got a good aroma. It does have what you consider.
It smells like it's going to taste like a gourd, basically.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a sip. Cheers to pumpkin puree.
Yep. That's actually smooth.
Almost has like a cantaloupe taste to it.
Yeah. Oh my God, we might have something.
Pumpkin juice.
This would go with my spicy wine.
It's really not bad.
I would totally drink this.
It's kind of like a cantaloupe.
Now, since it's sweet, I'm saying coconut rum.
All right, dump it in there, pal.
All right. Let me open it up first. Obi. Obi trying to get into pumpkin spice whatever.
I like pumpkin meatloaf. All right. Swish it around. A little rum and pumpkin juice. Normal Monday night.
Wait, why do you need to take a day off today?
I got fucked up on pumpkin juice. All right. Cheers.
Cheers. That totally works.
Yeah, it's not bad. Now, it's definitely grainy, like pulpy. Pulpy, that's the word I'm looking for. You get a lot of pulp when you're drinking this juice.
Yeah.
But it's not terrible.
The pumpkin's flowing through. Like, I was ready for us to just, like, spit this stuff out.
Yeah. In fact, the only thing I wanted to spit out was the pumpkin mole, the first one.
The pie one.
Yeah, the pie one. But second one. This one I could drink a little bit.
I'm going to pour myself a little more.
Oh, he's going for more.
I got the seed in there. It's like when you get the worm in tequila. Drink the seed.
What's funny is you know that if this was done by like a chef or a restaurant or something right in the fall, like a pumpkin dinner, that you could... People would buy tickets for it and try it out, like a whole pumpkin meal. Pumpkin meatloaf, doable. Pumpkin drink, doable. Pumpkin mole, probably needs some more lab time.
Yeah. We got to go through that a few more times.
I just think avocado and pumpkin might not be the best match together.
Nah, that's why I just said to myself, yeah, that's a good name.
I'm just picturing you like, shut up, Izzy, I'm working in here. Like, just like... All every dish in the house out like pumpkins, and you like throwing away different types of pumpkins. Like, this one doesn't work well.
But. I didn't say cords, I said pumpkins. There's a difference.
Well, buddy, it definitely works. I'm gonna see how I feel in about 5 minutes. if this settles in the stomach, okay. But not bad. Good effort. Yeah. Good effort. I wish someone else could, like, taste it, like a listener or something.
Tom Bagnano to get down here.
Let's send it to him in the mail. The meatloaf.
Send it snail mail. No. Get it to him in 10 days. No refrigeration whatsoever. Eat that guacamole.
But, all right, buddy. I guess at this time, it's time to put a wrap on the...
say our goodbyes.
The Halloween Extravaganza 5.0 song. But anything to promote, Berlew?
I would just promote, as we were talking about, my page, Michael Berlew, random stuff. Going another day with Pumpkin Spice, whatever, all through the month. At the end of the month, when Walking Dead comes back, because I know you're all looking forward to it. Tonight on The Walking Dead. And from there, I'm going to start thinking about some more monthly things I can do on the page, and I'll share it out with the Verbal Shenanigans crew.
The crew, a.k.a. me.
Yeah, pretty much.
We're a crew now?
I don't know. What counts as a crew? I mean, how many do you need?
I don't know.
I think two is enough.
I don't really know what counts as a crew. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I could be like, yo, my crew's coming over, and it's just it's just you.
Yo, my crew's coming over. Oh, it's him.
Oh.
My crew.
It's Berlew.
Two-man crew. Two-man crew, Berlew.
Two live crew. I just want to promote this show. First show at Paragon Tap and Table, November 8th, with headliner Mark Riccadonna.
Oh, very nice.
All right. I guess that's it, guys. Until next Halloween, hope you didn't get too scared. I hope you enjoy. it sounds like you just had a stroke.
I was good for a little bit, and then lost. It's like my imitation.
And then they always go to Russian.
Yeah.
But I guess keep listening, subscribing, go back into the catalog. There's a lot of good things. We have guests scheduled for months ahead, so we are very excited for a lot of episodes that are coming up. This might be a two-parter, so who knows if this outro even gets into the final. Who knows?
For now, it's a mystery.
It's a mystery, but life is funny, people. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
God, they're telling me to drink more pumpkin juice.
He spit orange liquid all over me.
Then he said, "Don't mess with me."
We've never seen a case so bad.